Good evening, Bible students. Are you ready to study? We're in the fourth book of the Bible, the book of Numbers. And tonight we come to chapter 10, chapter that I've been looking forward to because this is where the action really starts. In this chapter, God finally calls the nation of Israel to attention and then moves them out from Mount Sinai toward the promised land of Canaan. And then from here on out in the book of Numbers, as I've said multiple times now, we get lots of stories, histories of the nation of Israel in those early days and during the desert wanderings. And it's just like life, isn't it? There's going to be moments of success that we can learn from, and there's going to be a whole lot of failures that we can learn from. For the nation of Israel in the book of Numbers, I would have to say that this leans a whole lot further toward failures that you're learning from. It's tough to find those successes in the book of Numbers to learn from, lots of failures to learn from, but that's okay because if we're being honest, what we learn from our failures, those are the most valuable life lessons. They are. We can learn so much more from our failures. I know we don't like it when we're going through it, but when we are through it, when the Lord brings us out the other end, those lessons, those character traits that change in us because of all of the failures, they are the most valuable lessons that we can learn. Success, unfortunately, has a way of lulling us to sleep, making us feel way safer than we should. And unfortunately, that can lead to apathy in the body of Christ. That can lead to personal apathy for you. So our failures are so much better for us because they have a way of keeping us alert, holding our focus, keeping our attention, and preventing us from things that are future detrimentally to our Christian walk, our walk with the Lord, our faith. But that is getting ahead of ourselves. So that's what we're going toward in our study of Numbers. But tonight, we take a look at God and His nation as He calls them to attention and then mobilizes them and moves them out. And that is actually a pretty good, concise breakdown of this chapter. You could break it down like this, verses 1 through 11, God calling the nation to attention. And then verses 12 through 36, God moving the nation out. Now, verses 1 through 11, in order for God to call the nation of Israel to attention, He has to first establish a method of doing so. And I know maybe you're thinking, wait a minute, didn't He already do that? You know, the whole cloud by day, fire by night, Numbers chapter 9, last handful of verses there in that chapter. Yeah, that's a way for God to generally direct them. But let's face it, when that cloud begins to move in the daytime, not everyone's going to see that at the same time. If you're like me, you're busy, you're wrapped up in something, it may be a half hour before you see that thing. So the Lord needs a more precise way of getting the people's attention at the right moment. The first time the first person sees that cloud move, they can go to the priests. And, well, that's getting ahead of ourselves too. They can go to the priest because the Lord sets up this method whereby He can communicate the call for them to move. And there's more in this chapter than just that too. There are other things that the Lord sets up here as methods to call the people to different things. For example, we're going to see He sets this up so that He can call a board meeting. He can call the tribal leaders together, give them announcements and information, what have you. He can call the whole congregation of Israel to come to the opening, the door there of the outer courtyard of the tabernacle and do the same thing. Give them information, give them instruction, give them announcements, what have you. And there are ways, of course, for the Lord to more precisely mobilize His military. So that's all in here. The Lord is going to give a more detailed method of doing that. And we're going to take a look at the first verse here in Numbers chapter 10 and start digging our way through this. Verse 1. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, verse 2, make two silver trumpets of hammered work, you shall make them, and you shall use them for summoning the congregation and for breaking camp. Those are two different things right there. Summoning the congregation and for breaking camp as well. So these two silver trumpets had two purposes, at least as we get going here. That's what we're looking at in verse 1 and 2. Two purposes. Number one, to call the people to attention. And then number two, to direct the people in their mobilization. The nation of Israel is already at this point using shofars or ram's horns. We studied that. Exodus, Leviticus. Do you remember that? Are you with me? All right. Shofar, so good. All right. Stay with me. So they already had these ram's horns that they were blowing, that they were sounding. And this was for the purpose of, I guess you would say, religious stuff. This was for the purpose of calling them to worship, calling them to service there at the tabernacle. And that should make sense because this is the sacrificial system that we're talking about. So worship is based around sacrifice. So when the nation hears the sound of the ram's horns, so the sound of the trumpet, if you will, that comes from a sacrifice, then they know it's time to worship. But now the Lord has developed something new here in Numbers chapter 10, silver trumpets. And they're going to be for calling the nation together for instruction, announcement, mobilization, direction, even military purposes. So you hear the shofar, time to worship. You hear the silver trumpets, time to move. Not sure what it is yet because we got a lot of that to siphon through here and figure out. But you hear the shofar, time to worship. You hear the silver trumpets, we need to be moving. We need to be going somewhere. So here's the first part of how the silver trumpets work. Verse 3. And when both are blown, both trumpets, all the congregation shall gather themselves to you at the entrance of the tent of meeting. Verse 4. But if they blow only one silver trumpet by itself, then the chiefs, the heads of the tribes of Israel, shall gather themselves to you. So did you catch that? If you hear only one silver trumpet, that meant that the tribal leaders of the 12 tribes of Israel were to gather themselves together there at the front of the tabernacle, which would be right by the door of the outer courtyard, and that they were going to be hearing from the Lord in some way. So we would say elder meeting, board meeting, something to that effect, calling the leaders together, giving the leaders instruction, and then, of course, they would pass that on to their respective tribes. Now, if both trumpets were sounded, then that was to call the whole nation to attention. But different blasts of those two trumpets would mean different things, and so we get the instructions on those distinctions in verses 5 through 7. So let's read that. When you blow an alarm, now that word is a very precise word. That word would be short blasts with both trumpets. That's what the word alarm means. Short blasts with both silver trumpets. When you hear that alarm, the camps that are on the east side shall set out, verse 6. And when you blow an alarm the second time, more short blasts with both trumpets, then the camps that are on the south side shall set out. An alarm is to be blown whenever they are to set out. So in other words, that repeats the cycle. Both of those trumpets sound with the short blast. That means, okay, east side of the tabernacle, get moving. When you hear the next two trumpets blast out that sounding of alarm, the short blast, that means south side, it's your turn. The next one, west. And then, of course, the last one, the fourth one, would be north. Verse 7, but when the assembly is to be gathered together, so for the purpose of instruction and announcement and all of those different things that the Lord might have to speak to them, in that case, when the assembly is to be gathered together, you shall blow a long blast, but you shall not sound an alarm. So long sounding of the silver trumpets, both of them, that means the whole nation is to gather at the mouth of the outer courtyard there in the tabernacle. Short blast, that means move out, pack up, quick, move out. Now again, the book of Numbers is largely about organization And this chapter brings us right back to that, that God likes things to be done decently and in order. And then you study through the Bible, you get to the New Testament, and what do you know? You find out the Lord hasn't changed from the Old Testament to the New Testament. As Hebrews 13:8 says, He's the same yesterday and today and forever. So the Apostle Paul instructs the church in 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verse 40, that all things should be done decently and in order in the church. Now, I could, of course, turn this into a soapbox or a pig path, and I could have a lot of fun with that. But when you go to a church service that looks like just chaos and anything goes, and I don't know, did they even get to the worship service? I don't know. I can't tell what's going on. Did the pastor didn't get to speak? No. It was too good of a service. No. It was too out of order. And the Lord doesn't like that. The Lord likes things to be done decently and in order. And I'll just leave that at that. A lot of different points I could make there and examples that I could give you. But I won't do that because we've talked about this in the past. Verse 8. And the sons of Aaron, the priests, shall blow the trumpet. So it was a duty that only the priests could do. Levites couldn't sound the trumpets. And of course, the commoners of the nation of Israel in the congregation couldn't either. Reading on, the trumpet shall be to you for a perpetual statute. I find this extremely interesting. It's an interesting statement. Do you know what a statute is? A statute is a written law. And the Lord just said that the sounding of the trumpets are to be a perpetual statute to you. You know what that means? That means that when the Lord blasts out instructions and directions with the trumpets, that they are to treat that the same as they are the written laws of God. Whatever those orders are, march out, meet at the tabernacle. Elders only, whatever that trumpet blast is, it's as good as a law of God and that the people would need to obey. Now, did we read? Yeah, verse 8. Okay, we read verse 8. So, before we move on to verse 9 and we talk about the sounding of alarm, let's break down what we've just covered and fit it into its proper typology. If you ask the question, is there typology to be found in this chapter? The answer is yes, of course. Just about everywhere you look in the Old Testament, you're going to find typologies. And of course, there is one to be found in here with the blowing of the shofar, the ram's horn, and the blowing of the silver trumpets. The blowing of the shofar, which calls the nation of Israel to worship, typology for us, New Testament, would be that Christ, our sacrifice, calls us to worship the Father. Just think about this. Old Testament, the sounding of the horn from a sacrificial animal calls the nation to worship in the sacrificial system. In the New Testament, Jesus is our sacrifice. So it is Christ that calls us to worship the Father. It should be that when you see the cross, and I'm talking, you know, little emblems of the cross, you look over at the person sitting by in church and they got cross earrings in or a cross necklace on. Anytime that you see that cross, that ought to cause you to think about Jesus, our sacrifice. And when you think about Jesus, our sacrifice, that ought to call you to worship the Father for being so gracious to send us his Son as our sacrifice. Now, how about the silver trumpets? What would be the typology there? Well, they called the nation of Israel to pack up and move out. So the typology would be for the New Testament church. Well, how is the church going to know when it's time to pack it up here on earth and head out for the Lord's paradise, heaven with him for eternity? How are we going to know that, church? The same way. We're going to be called by the Lord with the sound of a trumpet. And of course, Paul tells us that in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 16 through 18, a verse that perhaps you could quote. I'll read them to you real quickly here. For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with the cry of command, with the voice of an archangel, and with the sound of the trumpet of God, And the dead in Christ will rise first. Then we who are alive, who are left, will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. And so we will always be with the Lord. Therefore, encourage one another with these words. So Numbers chapter 10, among many other things, it contains this nice little Old Testament portrait of the rapture of the church. At least that's what I see there. Maybe you see some other typological connection, but that's what I see there. Those trumpets were primarily to move them out, and that's how the Lord's going to move the church out one day. He's going to sound the trumpet, and then we'll be caught up with him. Verse 9. And when you go to war in your land, underline that phrase right there if you're taking notes, in your land, when you go to war in your land against the adversary who oppresses you, then you shall sound an alarm with the trumpets, that you may be remembered before the Lord your God, and you shall be saved from your enemies. Now, what I like about verse 9 is that the language that God uses here precisely communicates his will for the nation of Israel regarding warfare. Now, it is true, God is going to have them undertake a major conquest of the land of Canaan. And the Lord is going to have them go on the offensive and overcome the inhabitants of the land, conquer those cities in Canaan, and then turn that eventually into the land of Israel because of their success in conquest. So that's going to be an offensive war once they step foot in the promised land. But did you notice what verse 9 said? It said, after you come into your land, once you've settled down in the land of promise, once that offensive conquest of Canaan is all over, here's what the Lord does. He makes one allowance for warfare, and he says it's what? It's when you go to war in order to break free from the oppression of adversaries. We might put it like this. Once you get settled in Canaan, no more offensive wars, period. Defensive wars only. So it's very confirming then, as the Lord words that so precisely, he leaves the door open for their conquest into Canaan. That's going to be an offensive campaign. But once they get there, he shuts that all down and says, from now on out, defensive wars only. And you can follow the history of the nation of Israel from the time of their settling in Canaan, and you can see that they did a very good job of obeying God on this issue. First up would be King David. And under King David did wage some offensive wars, but every one of those offensive wars only took place because, unfortunately, the enemies had already conquered regions of Israel and taken those lands. So the offensive wars that David waged during his reign, those were in order to get back land that was stolen from them by the enemy. That was to set free the people in those cities that had been overcome and oppressed. But what you won't find is David engaging in an offensive war that wasn't to break free from the oppression of enemies. He's never going to do that. David is never going to say, you know what? If we go down and we overthrow that country, we'll be able to gain all sorts of money from it, or possessions, or oil fields, or what have you. There was never anything like that in the heart of David. It was all about defensive wars, defending the land, winning the land back if need be, but primarily defending the land and its people. And you can follow Israel's history from that time forward all the way to the present day, and their testimony is pretty much the same. They do a really good job of sticking with what the Lord said on this issue. The nation of Israel, by and large, they will do anything to keep peace. Make peace and keep peace. They've even given away sections of their land just to prevent a war from starting. Now, that was a mistake. They shouldn't have done that. But it shows you where their hearts and minds are on this issue. They want to make peace. They want to keep peace. They don't want to go to warfare. They want to avoid war at if at all possible. Their thinking is very biblical on this. And they should be commended for that. And we all know, in spite of that, Israel, like, never seems to have a day of peace, like, ever. They're always drug into some kind of battle or warfare, always. Why is that? That's because Satan hates God, and the Jews are his people, the apple of his eye. And so Satan hates the Jews. And so Satan is going to always make sure to incite and instigate someone to fire some missiles into Israel. It's always going to happen. They've been in war for a long time with very few days of peace in between. But they've done a great job of listening to the Lord. And don't worry too much for them, okay? Because one day they're going to come to know Jesus as their Messiah. And they're going to get that peace that they're looking for. You know, they pray the Shema every day, and they pray for the peace of Israel every day. They're going to get that peace one day. When they come to know Jesus as Messiah, they're going to get to partake in Messiah's kingdom, the millennial kingdom, where it will be perfect peace. I can't wait for Israel to get to experience that once and for all. Verse 10. On the day of your gladness also, and at your appointed feast, and at the beginning of your months, you shall blow the trumpets over your burnt offerings and over the sacrifices of your peace offerings. They shall be a reminder of you before your God. I am the Lord your God. So that concludes God's instructions on the use of trumpets for communication and direction, trumpets for horns for worship, all of that sort of thing. So check this out. Here we go. Verse 11, the moment we've all been waiting for. I'm so excited. Because we're going to get a story. Now, granted, it's just a tiny little story, but it's a story, and it's a great break from all of the laws that we've been studying, all of the instructions that we've been studying. We finally get some history, and here it is, verse 11. In the second year, in the second month, on the 20th day of the month. Now, before we get to the story, I know this is building suspense. You can hardly take it. But before we get to the story, I want to point out how significant that time stamp is. That's a time marker that lets us know where this sits in the history of the nation. Obviously, when they came out from Egypt, that was day one. And the book of Exodus, which details the exodus out of Egyptian bondage and into liberty there in the wilderness, that book Exodus covers that first year of Israel's history. This is stuff you should know. We've talked about this as we've gone, but we're going to build on what you know. So Exodus, the first year of Israel's history. Then we come to the book of Leviticus. And Leviticus takes place beginning on the first month of the beginning of their second year. So they've been free from Egypt for a whole year. On that first day of that first month, boom, the book of Leviticus begins to record, and the book of Leviticus records the next 30 days, the next month of the history of the nation. And then we come to Numbers, the book of Numbers. You can read chapter 1, verse 1, and that tells you that the account of Numbers begins to tick away on the first day of the second month, because Leviticus took 1 month, right? So now we're in the second month of that second year. Well, we just read verse 11, the first part of that, and it told us that when the nation finally begins to move out, because that's what's going to happen here, just let you know that, kind of maybe pacify the suspense a bit. Once the nation does finally begin to move out, it happens on the 20th day of the second month of the second year. What that tells us is that everything we have read, beginning at Numbers chapter 1, all the way to Numbers chapter 10, verse 10, that all took place in the space of 20 days. We're on the 20th day now. Verse 11 says this, reading it, we'll read the whole thing now. In the second year, in the second month, on the 20th day of the month, the cloud of God's presence lifted from over the tabernacle of the testimony. What a moment that must have been. Honey, look, the cloud is moving. Can you believe it? This is what we've been preparing for. This is what we've been waiting for. The Lord is going to take us to the land of promise. He's going to give us that land. We're going to have our own heritage on the earth. We can't wait. We've been waiting. We've been learning. We've been prepping. But now this is the moment. Enthusiasm for their new future must have been off the charts. Probably not a sour look on any of their faces. I would imagine all smiles and all cheers on this day. Because how could they not? Essentially, what's taking place here is the beginning of Israel arriving, truly arriving and becoming something sovereign and special in the eyes of the Lord. Well, how well did they do, you ask? Well, unfortunately, not very well. And I think the first verse of the next chapter, chapter 11, summarizes all of that quite well. After the nation breaks camp here and begin to do a tiny little bit of traveling, as I read this, I think they were traveling for 3 days. And after only 3 days of traveling, Numbers chapter 11, verse 1 tells us this. And the people complained in the hearing of the Lord. I don't even know why they need to put that in the scriptures. Why did Moses even include that? Because everything that's done is done in the hearing of the Lord. You can't even have a thought that escapes the hearing of the Lord. So the people complained in the hearing of the Lord about their misfortunes. And when the Lord heard it, his anger was kindled. I won't read the rest of the verse. We'll save that for next week. But just look at him. Day one, break camp. Yes, this is amazing. Oh, we've been waiting for this. 3 days later, woe is us. Traveling is hard. Camping in the desert that was barely tolerable. Hiking through the desert that is intolerable. This is terrible. How could we have to go through something like this? What a pitiful group, huh? I just want to encourage you tonight, don't be that kind of Christian. In fact, don't even be that kind of human being. If you're watching this on Facebook and you're not a Christian, don't even be that kind of human being. There's always so much for us to be grateful for and excited about. Wouldn't you agree with that? Always. So count your blessings. I never run out of them. I never do. I never run out of blessings to count. Sometimes they can get overshadowed for a little bit because of stuff I'm going through. But even in those moments, if I force myself to stop and count my blessings, it kind of makes me madder, you know, like, yeah, I'm mad. Yeah, Lord, you're right. You give me that and you've done that. I know. Kind of makes you madder, doesn't it? I know. I'm so blessed. How could I be mad? But I just am. Well, you should have plenty of blessings to count to. I don't care what your lot is in life. You got all sorts of blessings that you can count. So count them. And you'll lose place. You'll lose track of your sorrow and your pity party, your self-pity party. And you'll just start to be grateful and thankful. Well, we'll read more about that next week. Things are going to go badly for them as soon as they start getting some miles on the odometer in their travels. So we're going to have to really savor this moment. We're going to have to really savor how well they do in this chapter at mobilizing and getting themselves outside the camp gate. Because that's about all the longer it's good for them. Once they get out of the camp gate, things start to go very badly. But for this moment, they do this part really well. So we're going to take a look at that. We're going to see how all of these instructions for organization has paid off. We're going to read down through this with very little commentary, actually, because we've already studied how all of this works. Numbers chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 4, Numbers chapter 10, up to verse 10. That was all in preparation for this moment of mobilization. Now we're here. So the stuff that we all covered, that should come flooding back to you as we read down through these verses. You should be able to read down through these verses and go, okay, yep, I remember this guy and he's with that group. Yep, and he's doing what he's supposed to do. And the next guy and the next group, yep, they're doing the right thing. You should be able to do that. If you can't, If you read down through this and you're totally lost, I don't know what to tell you. I'm sorry to tell you, but what you really need to do is go back through those studies, listen to them again, Numbers chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, and chapter 4, until you can read this section and do that. But I'll leave that up to you. I had to tell you the truth. Sorry, not sorry. It's the way it is. Verse 12. So here we go. And the people of Israel set out by stages from the wilderness of Sinai, and the cloud settled down in the wilderness of Paran. Now, Paran means abounding in foliage. It means beauty, glory, ornament. The Lord has brought them to a beautiful place that is abundant in plant life, in the desert. That's the first spot that the Lord brings them to. That tells me that the Lord is starting them off very easy. Somehow he finds this spot with abundant plant life, all sorts of life in the middle of the desert. And the Lord says, we'll bring them there first. See how it goes. We'll start them off easy. We'll put them in an abundant spot and see how they respond. And of course, we just read how they respond. Oh, this is miserable. This is not the way I pictured it. It's good, but it's not perfect. So they're going to complain, even though the Lord starts them off easy. Verse 13, they set out for the first time at the command of the Lord by Moses. Verse 14, the standard of the camp of the people of Judah set out first by their companies. You should know why that is. Numbers chapter 2. That's because Judah and the tribes connected to Judah were positioned on the east side of the tabernacle, right there by the door of the tabernacle. You had the Levites in between them, but then those encampments of Judah and their joined tribes, they were right there on the east, and the Lord always started the movement of the camp with the east. And it always went clockwise. Do you remember that from Numbers chapter 2? That's all right if you don't, but it's in there. We studied it. So you start east and you go clockwise around the compass points. East moves out first. That's Judah. Then you go south. Then west moves out. And then finally and fourthly, that would be north. Continuing on in verse 14. And over their company was Nashon, the son of Amminadab, 15. And over the company of the tribe of the people of Issachar was Nethanel, the son of Zuar. And over the company of the tribe of the people of Zebulun was Eliab, the son of Helon. And when the tabernacle was taken down, the sons of Gershon and the sons of Merari, who carried the tabernacle, set out. And the standard of the camp of Reuben set out by their companies. And over their company was Elizur, the son of Shedeur. And over the company of the tribe of the people of Simeon was Shelumiel, the son of Jurishadai. You remember all these names, right? All right, you can probably even pronounce them by now. Verse 20, and over the company of the tribe of the people of Gad was Eliasaph, the son of Duel. Then the Kohathites set out, carrying the holy things, and the tabernacle was set up before their arrival. So they wanted the tabernacle to get in place first, get all set up, and then the rest of the people were to arrive. Verse 22, and the standard of the camp of the people of Ephraim set out by their companies, and over their company was Elishama, the son of Ammihud. And over the company of the tribe of the people of Manasseh was Gamaliel, the son of Pedazur. And over the company of the tribe of the people of Benjamin was Abidan, the balloon slayer, son of Gideoni. Verse 25, does your Bible not say that? Maybe that's just mine. That's because I wrote it in there. That's why it says that. Then the standard of the camp of the people of Dan, acting as the rear guard of all the camps, set out by their companies, and over their company was Ahizer, the son of Amishadai. And over the company of the tribe of the people of Asher was Pagiel, the son of Ochran. And verse 27, and over the company of the tribe of the people of Naphtali was Ahira, the son of Enan. Verse 28, this was the order of march of the people of Israel by their companies when they set out. So no issues reported in this section. It seems to have gone swimmingly. Their organization and mobilization seems to be a glaring success. You got trumpets blaring. You got tribal flags flying. You got tribes marching determined steps. You've got over 3 million people, we would guess, moving in perfect order. Everyone seems to know what they're doing and what they're supposed to be doing. So basically what you have here is a big, great, glamorous 3 million people parade for the glory of God. That's what you got going on right now. And I'm sure it was a wonderful moment for the nation. Everyone, I'm sure, was happy because it's really easy to smile at a parade. And these poor folks have no idea of the hard times that are ahead for them, do they? They have no idea how difficult things are going to get on this journey. This is such a great book to teach us about the Christian journey, isn't it? The Lord calls you. You're just excited and raring to go. You're ready to follow. You think all of your problems are long behind you because you're a Christian now. Oh, how incredibly naive that is. Your problems aren't behind you. Life, Christian or non-Christian, life can be hard. And life can be harder on some than it is others. And just because you're a Christian, that doesn't mean everything's going to be okay now and that you're never going to experience problems. Granted, it's better than the alternative, and that is going through the hardships of life without the help of God. You have the Lord, so he's going to help you. He's going to be there with you for all of the hard, and he's probably going to exclude you from a lot of the stuff that you would have gone through if you weren't with him on his journey. Prayer matters, folks. So those prayers you pray, Lord, help me this day, protect me from this and keep me from that. You know how often the Lord probably does that? And if you hadn't prayed that, your day may have looked very different, your week or your year. So the Lord is good to us, sharing this journey with us, but it's still a hard journey, even for the Christian. We go through very dry places. We get stuck in some very low valleys. We get asked to climb some really steep inclines on our journeys. So isn't it a good thing that the Lord doesn't sit you down at the beginning and tell you everything that you're going to go through if you sign up for Christianity? You know, like Arlen, okay, you're ready to take up your cross, deny yourself. You're ready to lose this life and find the true life. Okay, great. Before you do, we should probably go over the itinerary for you. Here's the stuff you're going to go through. Here's some of the stuff you're going to face. Here's how you're going to feel. This is what your 30, 40-year journey is going to look like. And then I would probably just be like, oh, that's a lot. Can I think about it before I give you a decision? I'm going to need to think about this. I think if we knew in advance, a lot of us would maybe opt out from the beginning. I know that was the case for the rich young ruler, wasn't it? He was just revealed to of what he was supposed to give up for the Lord, and that was too much for him. So the Lord definitely set this up right. And the way he set it up is that the just shall live by faith. It is much easier that way for us in the Christian faith. It's just a little bit of faith at a time and a couple tiny steps at a time. You get a nice rest. You get to recover from that. And then you're called on to express a little more faith and take a few more steps. And you get a break. And maybe you get knocked back a few steps here and there. But the Lord takes us through this journey so gradually, revealing the next step when we get to the next step. He does that so that we're not focused on the length of the journey and the immensity of what's up ahead for us, but that we can stay present, focused on the here and now, getting to that next stage, taking that next step, having faith for the moment and those kind of things. And it's only in hindsight when all of that is over and you've been doing this, you know, little bit of faith here, little bit of faith there, a few steps here and a few steps there. And all of a sudden, 30 years later, 40 years later, you look back and you realize that what you've done is you've put together a journey. You've been with the Lord on a journey. And you've been places you never would have thought of. And you faced things that you never would have wanted to. But the Lord was with you all the way, faithful to you, pulling you through, giving you victory and success in the face of all the odds that came your way. That's the best way for us to look at our journeys with the Lord. Just right now, right here, what am I doing for the Lord? Where is the Lord taking me? All I need is faith for that. I don't need faith for what's going to happen tomorrow or a week from Wednesday or a couple years from now. I need faith for where I am right now. I need to be able to trust the Lord, not give up or go back, but trust him right now, right here, for where he and I are on this journey that we call Christianity. Such a good book to teach those lessons. I'm so thankful, so grateful for this book. The Lord has packed so much wisdom in here for us. Well, now we get our first little story here, okay? This is really, truly the story, verse 29. So let's check this out without further ado. And Moses said to Hobab, the son of Reuel, or Jethro. Jethro and Reuel, those two names are used interchangeably for the same person, Moses' father-in-law, in the scriptures. You can read Reuel in Exodus chapter 2. You can read Jethro in other places. We don't know why this guy had two names, but we know that he did. He was referred to by two different names. And I guess it's not too surprising for us. We're kind of used to that. You know, you have Jacob, but he's also Israel. And then the further you go through the scriptures, you'll see that multiple names for one person. So Reuel is definitely Jethro, the father-in-law of Moses. So Moses said to Hobab, the son of Reuel, or Jethro, the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law. Now, if you remember from the book of Genesis, Moses married a Midianite woman, a Gentile woman by the name of Zipporah. You remember that? He married her when he was in hiding in Midian, trying to escape the heat that was on him there in Egypt. So he marries this Midianite woman, this Gentile woman named Zipporah. Well, Hobab is Jethro's son. So Hobab is Zipporah's brother, which makes Hobab the brother-in-law of Moses. Now, Zipporah did have another brother, and his name was Hobad, and he was a disgruntled gardener. I shouldn't have tried that one. No, that's not true. Hobad's not really a person. So Hobab is Zipporah's brother and Moses' brother-in-law. Now, there's a lot of controversy about this. If you read up until Judges chapter 4, verse 11, you're fine. You'll understand Reuel to be the same as Jethro. That's the father-in-law of Moses. You'll understand, based on verse 29, that Hobab is the son of Jethro. So it's Moses' brother-in-law. But when you get to Judges chapter 4, verse 11, that verse refers to Hobab as, in just about every translation, the father-in-law of Moses. And then you're like, what is happening? Okay, is Hobab the father-in-law of Moses, or is Jethro, or is Reuel? They can't all be the same person, because verse 29 says that Hobab was the son of Reuel. So what? Who is what here? And it gets all confusing. Well, the only reason it's confusing is because in the Hebrew language, as it was written, there were no vowels. I've shared that with you multiple times before. There were only consonants in the original Hebrew. Now, they've since added vowel dots and slashes and lines in order to indicate what the vowel soundings are, but the way that Hebrew was originally written for many, many years, consonants only. Now, when you come to the word father-in-law, the way this would be written in Hebrew would be He, Tav, Nun, or as we would say, H-T-N. That's how you write father-in-law. Well, guess how you write brother-in-law? H-T-N. Hey, Tav, Nun. Same thing. So when you're reading these two words in Hebrew, in the original manuscripts, that word could be either brother-in-law or father-in-law. Father-in-law would be, we would spell it like this, H-O-T-E-N. And brother-in-law, we would spell like this, H-A-T-A-N. But those consonants are identical. So what happened is, I believe, if I understand this correctly, during the writing of the Biblica Leningradensia, when those vowel markings were all added, those vowel markings were added incorrectly. And so they assumed this meant father-in-law in Judges 4:11 when it really should be brother-in-law. So there's really no issue there. It's just a mess up with vowel markings because the original Hebrew didn't have that. You can either take my word for that or you can dig into that yourself. Maybe you're saying, we don't care. Could you just move on, Arlen? So that's what we're going to do. Those are things that interest me, but yeah, I get it. Don't worry, I get it. So reading on in verse 29, this is what Moses said to Hobab. We are setting out for the place which the Lord said, I will give to you. Come with us, and we will do good to you, for the Lord has promised good to Israel. So Moses wants his brother-in-law Hobab, a Gentile, to join them on this journey to the promised land. Verse 30, but he said to him, I will not go. I will depart to my own land and to my kindred. But Moses isn't going to let things go quite that easily. He's going to try to talk Hobab into this. Verse 31, and he said, please do not leave us, for you know where we should camp in the wilderness. We need you, and you will serve as eyes for us. We can really use your help with things like reconnaissance. We need you to be a good set of eyes for us. Verse 32, and if you do go with us, whatever good the Lord will do to us, the same will we do to you. So Moses says, look, you just got to go. We need you. We can really use you. You'll be valuable to us in our travels. Some people criticize Moses for this because, and I get it, it could seem as though Moses is trying to fill a role that only the Lord wants to fill, and that is to be the guy that to be the one that directs the nation and tells them where to camp and where not to camp. But that just isn't the case at all, and that's not what's happening here, at least in my opinion. Regardless of what Hobab does, that's not going to change any of the travel plans as far as the Lord is concerned. Here's how they work, verses 15 through 23, Numbers chapter 9. That's always going to be in play. When the cloud moves, the people move with the cloud. Wherever the cloud stops, that's where the people stop and set up camp. But you got to realize that cloud, it takes up a lot of space. And it drops you in a region. And now you got to be smart within that region to determine where to set up camp. And if you don't know those desert regions like Hobab does, you're at a loss. And so you got to try to figure out, is this a good place to set up camp or not? Well, a guy like Hobab, you could have him alongside and he could say, definitely you don't want to encamp over near those rocks. Lots of snakes over there. Lots of snake bites. You definitely don't want to camp over there by that water. The skeeters will eat you alive. So he has valuable topographical and geographical information that could help them in things like that, setting up their camp. And because he knows the area, he's a good guy for reconnaissance. What's that group over there? That's Philistines. We better get moving. So he could be valuable. I don't think that Moses had any intention that this guy Hobab was going to take the Lord's place in directing them to the promised land. I don't believe that whatsoever. So verse 33, so they set out from the mount of the Lord 3 days' journey. And we go, wait a minute. Whoa, hold on. What happened to Hobab? What did Hobab decide to do? Who's the they in verse 33? Is Hobab included in the they? Is he one of the theys? Did he go? Or did he stay behind? Did Moses talk him into it? Did Moses persuade him or not? Well, if you go to that verse I already quoted to you, Judges chapter 4, verse 11, you're going to see mentioned there the descendants of Hobab, the brother-in-law of Moses. And what that tells us is that Hobab did take Moses up on this offer. Hobab was convinced by Moses' pleadings, and Hobab eventually becomes a part of the nation of Israel, a Gentile, and now he becomes part of the lineage. He, along with other Jews that he would mix with, now that's all just a part of the tribes of Israel. Incredible how his story works. Reading on, and the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord went before them 3 days' journey to seek out a resting place for them. Verse 34, and the cloud of the Lord was over them by day whenever they set out from the camp. Verse 35, and whenever the ark set out, Moses said, arise, O Lord, and let your enemies be scattered, and let those that hate you flee before you. 36, And when it rested, he said, "Return, O Lord, to the 10,000s of Israel." So you have right there two different prayers, two great prayers. You have a prayer for setting out, and you have a prayer for settling in. One is a prayer, "Lord, be with me as I set out." And the other one is a prayer, "Lord, be with me as I settle in." And that's kind of what the Jews do with, have you ever seen the little scrolls they have hanging on their doors? And as they go out, they'll kiss their finger and touch the little Hebrew scroll and say, "Lord, bless my going." And when they come back into the house, they kiss it and touch the scroll and they said, "Lord, bless my coming." It's the same kind of prayer. I admit I have one of those. I admit I do that. But these are really the two most important moments in a Christian's day. Jews too, but let's just bring this down to us because we're out of time here. The two most important moments in a Christian's day, number one is setting out for the day, and then number two is settling in for the day. And both of those moments in your day should be marked with these two kinds of prayers, or at least thoughts. You know, prayer number one, as you're setting out for the day, as you're leaving your house, "Lord, show yourself strong in my life today. Whoop my enemies. Anyone who comes against me, Lord, you take care of them. You, Lord, just help me on my path and be with me no matter what I face today. Bring me victory over my challenges all day long, Lord." Jesus put it like this in the model prayer, Matthew chapter 6, verse 13, "Lead us not into temptation." That word means trials, testing, tribulation, temptation. It means all those things. "Lord, lead me not into temptation, trials, testing, tribulation, but deliver me from evil." The Lord told us to pray that way. That's a great prayer for setting out. And then when your day comes to an end and you get to settle in with the Lord, that's what verse 36 is. It's a call to be settled in with the Lord. "Lord, you got me through this. Now I can reflect on today's challenges. They're done. Time to settle in with you, Lord. And I need you here in my home with me too." Because if you're settling in close to bedtime, that means you're going to sleep. That's your most vulnerable time in all of your day. It's the most vulnerable period of your 24 hours when you're asleep. And you need the Lord for that too, for that protection, that care, and that protection. So beautiful prayers. Keep these in mind as you set out and settle in every day. You need the Lord for all of it. All right, let's stand. We'll close in prayer.